Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
I think to connect to the general topic of this conference, the sociology of international criminal justice, I think it's a very timely topic. My assumption or starting point is that international criminal law, international law in general, but also law in general, whether it's domestic or international, is a response to social needs. And I think that was a point that Judge Baraguana made already in his presentation in the previous session. And if we have this assumption that law, international criminal justice, is a response to social needs, it has implications both for practicing lawyers. I mean, when we approach a concrete problem, in certain situations, it may be relevant to take notice of these social needs. What do we seek to accomplish? But not only as practicing lawyers, but also as legal scholars, when we analyze law and what is happening, and we're taking a little bit kind of an external perspective to ask, is the legal system responding to these social needs? Are we doing what we have set out to do? If I put this a little bit in context of my previous research, in my book Power and Law in International Just in International Law, I focus on the impact of law, not only in the field of international criminal justice, also in other fields. It could be human rights, use of force, and so on. I've focused on the question of whether law actually influences state behavior. I'm not going to do that today because the theme of the conference was more what is the input or what is coming into the system, and a little bit less kind of the impact on the system, on what is happening on the ground. If we perceive law as a response to social needs, you can make an interesting observation, because we have here scholars from law, political science, sociology, anthropology, and more fields, and we have an interest in the same social phenomena, but we're using different techniques. And from a legal perspective, I mean, as a legal scholar, I find it a little bit difficult sometimes to describe what we're doing. And others may ask, what are we doing as legal scholars? So I think it presses for engagement between the different disciplines. And what I will do today is trying to fuse legal perspective with social science perspectives. And I can already now apologize if I'm simplifying matters which are clear for other scholars coming from other fields, or if I misunderstand you, but you have to bear with me. When we're planning this conference and I was setting out my own topic, I opted for the title of this presentation, Rebels, Rogue States, and Scapegoats in the Crosshairs. And initially my idea was to go through different examples to prove my point, but then I started to think that maybe better to have a bird's eye perspective. I will give you examples, but I will try to keep the bird's eye perspective and not get stuck in examples. Now, this is the outline, so I'll talk a little bit about structure versus agency. International criminal justice as a regime, a little bit of examples, and then a conclusion. Already yesterday, in several presentations, for example, in Kirsty's presentation, you were talking about agency and process. So I'm coming back to that a little bit now. This is a familiar concept in social sciences, and it's we're talking about it in different ways, using different words, but essentially that is what we're talking about. And the next picture may be a little bit simplistic, but again, bear with me. So a key question, I think, for this conference that many have asked, should the perceived bias of the International Criminal Court, and I'm thinking about kind of the selection of cases and the type of crimes that are being investigated or prosecuted, Is that explained by choices and policies adopted by international criminal justice actors, and I'm thinking primarily about the prosecutor, or is this choice already made in the structure of the system? And I will focus on the second part, that is after the or, the structural constraints. The first perspective, kind of focusing on the choices made by prosecutors and actors, that's also a very important discussion, but I will focus on the later part. This structure versus agency perspective, it's a basic question in social science. To what extent should explanation be couched in terms of autonomous actions of individuals or actors, or seen as a product of context or structure in which the individual operates and of which they have no control? I mean, that's a key question in social science. And if we try to describe this graphically, this is something I found on the internet, it's an interplay between, at the bottom we have human agents, it could also, it's individuals, but it could also be individuals acting in an official capacity. And on the top we have social structure. A social structure could involve resources, norms, institutions, and so on. And the key point of this illustration is that structure influences agents, but the agents also influence the structure. So there's a kind of feedback. So that's the key point of this picture. The influence coming from the structure is internalized by the actors as values and roles, and then the agents by their action reproduce the structure. You can also find examples where the actors choose not to reproduce, to diverge from the norms. It's difficult, but it could happen. If you're kind of critical of the system, that is something good. But we have to admit that lawyers are quite conservative. I mean, if you're saying judges that they should break out of the system, that is something normally we don't want the judges to do. But if you're critical of the system, that is something good. But it's just to put it a little bit in perspective. If I may quote some scholars that are probably familiar to do, is Crutcherville and Ruggie, who state that actors not only reproduce normative structures, they also change them by their very structure. So there's room for individuals and actors to change the system, but the system is often by its nature conservative or resistant to changes. Social scientists, they use this dichotomy, structure and agency. Lawyers would maybe call it different, would use it different terms. We'd call it judicial lawmaking. That's when the judges try to break out of the bounds. And normally as lawyers, we think that is bad. But if we adopt a critical perspective, it could be good in certain cases. And I've seen sociologists that call this structuration. So it's different words for the same thing. Now, if we take this perspective into international criminal justice and we try to rephrase it, structures are understood as international systems and laws within which the actors of the international criminal tribunals and courts, and with this I mean the judges, prosecutors, defense counsels, and other actors operate. Now, if we have this approach, it depends a little bit on the perspective. If you have this global perspective or local micro perspective, I mean, where should we put different entities? So let's take the example of states. Are states part of the structure or are they the agents? And I would argue they have a dual role. States are creating the structure, they're a community. There may be imbalances between the states, but they create the structure as a community. But states may also be actors. Sometimes they ask to do something by the court, or they may intervene in cases. So states have a dual role, and you can probably find more examples. I was thinking about Sergei Vasilev's presentation with Indrugovins, sorry if I didn't pronounce it right. Are they structure or are they actors? It depends a little bit on the perspective. In a sense, they create structure for the actors of the court, but in a sense, they can also be the subject of power of the state. So you can, it's not always clear cut where you should put different entities. And I've tried to graphically illustrate this following the example that I found on the internet. So the structure, here I have flag of the UN. With that, I mean the community of states. We have money, resources, and here I put Pax Americana, and I was thinking about your presentation yesterday, Morten. You were talking about Pax Romana. So that's one way of describing the current structure. The agents, here we have examples, I mean actors of the court, but I've also put world leaders, not necessarily leaders of state parties, but they also have a role in this system, in interacting with these institutions, leaders of countries that are not members. And again, we have the structure that kind of enables and constrains the actors. It can be through norms, resources, or values. It's internalized via resources and rules. And then we have a reproduction or production. I mean, if the actors can shape new norms. So that's one way of looking at the system. I read an interesting article. It was in the Journal of International Criminal Justice of Kiani from last year that set up a typology of selectivity in international criminal justice. I mean, to try to explain why do we have certain cases and certain crimes that are investigated and prosecuted. And Kiani explains this in terms of selectivity. And Kiani is a special interest of group-based selectivity. I will mention that briefly. That's the key point of Kiani. And when I read this article of Kiani, I felt that Kiani is saying, in essence, what I'm saying, also concerned about structure and agency. So let's see if we can kind of amalgamate these two perspectives. So on the right-hand side, I put this structure versus agency perspective. And with structure, I find the five first ones, material selectivity. With that is meant the type of crimes that can be prosecuted in these courts. And that is set by the statutes of the courts. We have procedural selectivity. I mean, the procedures are set by the states, by the structure. We have geographic selectivity. These tribunals, they're limited in space. Temporal selectivity. Then I've added capacity selectivity. That's the resources that are given to the courts. I see that as part of the structure. And then we have agency. That is the choices made within the courts, within the tribunals. And then lastly, we have group-based selectivity. What Kiani is interested of is that in certain situations, we have crimes committed both by the government and non-state actors. And what we can see in many cases is that only the rebels, the non-state actors, are prosecuted and not the government or groups that are in power. And Kiani has this third world approach to international law and is critical against that and tries to explain it. And so I start to ask myself, is that the question of structure or agency? I would say it's probably both that explains why we have this, but rather more agency. I mean, it's a choice that has been made by the prosecutors to investigate one crime but not investigate the other. I mean, this is open for debate. I mean, this is just one way of looking at it. I'm not going to go through this table, but it's a table which answers these four key jurisdictional issues: what crimes can be prosecuted, which persons can be prosecuted, limits in time, limits in space, that's kind of the columns. And then if we go to the rows, we have the different jurisdictions. And I'm not going to go through this table, but it shows us that they vary, the tribunals, in these regards. I mean, this is obvious. We all know about this. But this hasn't happened by some kind of random event. It's conscious choices made by the states. And that sets the structure. Now, I'm going over now to give some examples. So I will start with material constraints, where it's kind of examples where the states have made choices. They've used their power to make choices. So one choice that has been made is torture is not criminalized as a discrete crime. I mean, it's criminalized as a war crime. It's criminalized as a crime against humanity. And the relevant question is, why is that? Does that protect any certain states or certain interests? Why was it excluded as a discrete crime? Certain conventional weapons are prohibited under the Rome Statute, but not nuclear weapons. And there's a debate whether chemical and biological weapons are prohibited under the Rome Statute. Me personally, I think they're criminalized, but you could debate it. So we could ask ourselves, why have the states criminalized certain conventional weapons, which certainly are awful for if they were used, but in if we compare, they cause much less damage compared to weapons of mass destruction. So why have we prohibited one type of weapon but not others? I mean, it's obvious, it's interests and powers of states. We had the presentation by Dr. De Hono about the crime of aggression. Why wasn't that included originally? Again, it's a question of power and interests. Then we have territorial constraints. In the Rome Statute, we have this option of UN Security Council referrals, and that clearly grants a certain group of states more power than other states. And that was also a choice to include that. I mean, we can understand why it happened, but it was still a choice. And certain powers, they're outside the jurisdiction of the court, they have a veto power. So this is also an example of the imbalances in the system. If we continue temporal constraints, we have in Article 124 a 7-year exception for war crimes, which as I understand was used by France. This is also an expression of power and interests. And again, the crime of aggression, it will not come under the jurisdiction of the court until 2017. If we continue with more examples, we have examples of personal constraints. The jurisdiction of the court of the ICC can either be restricted in terms of territory, but also be restrained or connected to the citizenship of a person. Immunity is also an example of personal constraints where certain categories of officials are protected. That's also a conscious decision and expression of power. And we also have the Article 16 deferrals, where some states have been excluded from the jurisdiction of the court. We have the early resolutions from 2002 and 2003, which the US pushed through in order to protect their troops and their officials. And we have later examples with the referral of the situation in Sudan and later Libya to the court, where you can see the same phenomena. So that's also examples how power has been used to protect certain persons or categories of persons. If we continue a little bit in this critical vein, the principle of complementarity is also an expression of power and interests. The Article 17 established a dichotomy between functioning states on the one hand and failed states. And normally the principle of complementarity is described as a cornerstone of the ICC, a crucial explanation why the states accepted it, and it's described in a positive manner. But if we adopt a bit more critical manner, it's a way of protecting the functioning states, while as the failed states are the ones that are put at trial in a sense. And we could ask ourselves, what is the historical culpability of the global north for the role of state failure? That's a question we could ask. Now, I'm turning the focus a little bit on my presentation, and I'll go over to the concept of hegemony. And hegemony is a way of describing the relationship between structure and agency. In the context of international relations, it describes how one or a few powers which have agency on their own also has major influence on the structure of the international system. And how should we understand hegemony? It's to move the interests of the hegemon from the realm of the special, the interest of that state, and to phrase it or to make it appear as natural, a question of general interest. And now I'm kind of putting forward a quite critical perspective of the state of being, but hegemony doesn't necessarily have to be bad. If I may go back to your presentation, Morten, you were talking about Octavius, I believe, as a benevolent hegemon. I don't know if you use that words. The benevolent dictator. So one could argue that we need a benevolent hegemon, and then it's a question of facts whether we have that or not. But one could argue that we need the hegemon, because what is the alternative? I mean, the ultimate alternative is anarchy, chaos. So that's the next question I'm kind of asking: is hegemony bad? And the word, it has a negative connotation. And here I have Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility. Because we had a discussion yesterday, and I put one of your statements on Twitter, Morten, where you were very critical. And I have a judge, he's a judge in a district court in Sweden who followed me. And he wrote as a response, with great power comes great responsibility. So if you have this hegemon, which is benevolent, good, if they use that power in a good way, maybe we can accept it. So Spider-Man can represent that. Now, if we talk about hegemony in international criminal justice, and we again adopt a little bit more critical perspective, Western principles. This is an argument made by Robinson. He's trying to defend the current order, but he puts forward an argument, a point of criticism, that Western principles is at fault when, as they impose individual criminal responsibility in relation to collective activities. Whereas ordinary crimes constitute deviance from social expectations, international criminal law is faced with inverted morality, where there's a strong social pressure to participate in the crimes instead it is abstention from crime that is deviant. So the question is, can we apply the same principles as we do in a domestic order on the international scene? So this is an argument against that. Robinson later in the same article argues against himself. I will get back to that. And this Kiani's group-based differentiation, that's an example of that, who are we to impose our norms or our values on these persons? They may have legitimate concerns and purposes that they fight for. If we talk about hegemony in international criminal justice, is the problem structure or agency? Is the problem that the prosecutor is making bad choices, or is it the structure that causes the problems that we perceive? Here it's interesting to note that if we discuss the discretion of the prosecutor, a common argument is that if we give the prosecutor wider discretionary powers, it will become politicized. But think about it for a minute. Let's say that we would decrease this discretion and have more guidance and more rules. That doesn't mean that politicization will disappear. It will just be somebody else who does it. So we have to be a little bit careful when we discuss politicization. If we kind of remove it in one part, it may reappear somewhere else. So if I continue on with this question, Cowell makes the argument that the narrative that I see as an imperialist institution to a larger extent is due to the provisions of the Rome Statute itself rather than continent choices made by the court organs. So as I see it, Cowell is putting the blame on structure and not agency. I have a forthcoming article with Louisa Bordegård where we've analyzed the choices made by the OTP. I'm not going into that because I'm concerned with structure, but in this article we kind of go after agency. Our observation is that the OTP in its strategic documents and the actual cases that they've started to investigate and prosecute are downplaying their own discretion by emphasizing legalistic and apolitical character of its decision making and bringing the objectives of ending impunity, preventing crimes, and providing redress to victims to the force. So they're kind of, we're not the political body, we're doing these things that we have been ordered to do, but if we go below the surface, we can see that choices have been made. We've had some speakers who've been putting realism against legalism, so I will do that a little bit also. Legal scholars in the realist tradition argue that international courts not controlled by powerful states will usually be ineffective. States of major power will approach a court such as the ICC in two ways, marginalization and control. And marginalization is discourage states to support the court, to join the court. Major powers can allow the court to operate as long as it's doing its bidding. So that's kind of two instruments of power. The ICC may react to these kind of external pressures, primarily through the prosecutor, either by being apolitic, that's our observation. They can be pragmatic, strategic, to respond to these external pressures in a strategic manner, or a captured behavior, that they become the slaves of the major powers. So this is the arguments made by Bosco. If you continue, that was the same. Then we have liberal approach, which also can see that hegemony can play a positive role. That was a little bit kind of the benevolent emperor. And then we have the constructivist approach, which has also been mentioned earlier, where we kind of accept that the norms of states can change, and even major states may, under certain conditions, accept the court. I mean, if you look at states as the UK and France, it's examples of states that, I mean, they have the resources, they have the power to escape, but they've chosen to subject themselves, and it's a case where the values or the interests of states may change. Lastly, alternatives to hegemony. I will skip this slide and we'll go to the last one. An alternative is anarchy, impunity. I mean, if we don't have these courts, crimes will go unpunished. A second alternative is domestic investigation and prosecution. And these alternatives are not mutually exclusive. One could think about, of course, international and domestic prosecution at the same time. Or multi-stakeholder governance. I perceive this as the ideal that many have, that we should have a system where, well, we can have certain imbalances between powers, but not a single state can control what is happening, and that is the perceived ideal. Are we there? How do we get there? If we're not there, we could discuss, but this is different alternatives to hegemony. So that was my presentation, and so we'll go into the Q&A session now.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.